This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. The Oklahoma City bombing trial began today in Denver, Colorado. Timothy McVeigh is charged with blowing up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City 2 years ago, killing 168 people and wounding hundreds more. It was the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. Terry Nichols, who was a co-defendant in this case, will be tried separately at the end of the trial. The prosecution has its work cut out for it because much of the evidence is circumstantial. And the FBI crime lab, which has analyzed the physical evidence of the case, has been severely criticized for its shoddy work. The defense also has its work cut out for it because if McVeigh is found guilty, he could face the death penalty. This high-profile trial has drawn thousands of reporters to Denver, including Jeffrey Toobin. Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for ABC News. He was an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn before becoming a journalist and reported on the trials of O.J. Simpson. His book about that famous case, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, just came out in paperback. I talked with Jeffrey Toobin yesterday about what we should expect to hear and how he's prepared himself to cover the trial.
I read everything that I can about the facts of the case. I also try to get to know the lawyers a little bit. It really is sort of like a political campaign in that there is a tremendous buildup and a lot of background information, but things do change dramatically once the trial starts, and it's hard to catch up once. You know, the jury is impaneled and each day's developments are going. So I really, I try to bone up first.
How do you even, and this may be a silly question, but how do you even stay in shape? Because you have to, you're in a different city, you're sitting all day and watching something, probably not talking very much. Do you have to think about making sure you eat well and sleep well and stay mentally prepared?
Sitting in courtrooms, it can be one of the most excruciating experiences on earth. Only when I was a day camp counselor have I suffered as much as when I was been covering cases. I had a similar experience during some of the OJ trial and when I was a day camp counselor, a job I didn't really enjoy very much. I would look at my watch in the morning and say, the little hand has to get all the way around to 4.5 until I can leave here, and I think I'm going to lose my mind first. And that's and during boring parts of trials, you can feel that way, and time seems to stand still. But these events are sufficiently unpredictable that you sort of have to be there.
Judge Mache has ordered that journalists sit behind a wall, which has been constructed in the courtroom, which really would block the view of the jurors. Is it important for you as a journalist to be able to keep your eye on individual jurors or all of the jurors?
I find it very important because, especially when you've been dealing with cases that are televised, the one advantage you have in a courtroom is that you can see the jury, whereas on television you can never see the jury. Here in the McVeigh case, where there is no television at all, we are the eyes of the public in that courtroom.
Well, the judge has said that he's concerned about protecting the privacy, the anonymity of the jurors. And he's also said that he doesn't want jurors tainted by media coverage or even tainted by the media presence. My understanding is that thousands of journalists have descended on Denver. Do you think a judge should be concerned about so many people from the outside and concerned about the privacy of people who have a very important job before them?
Those are all admirable considerations. I mean, you can't argue with wanting to protect people from harassment. But it's also important to remember that jury service is not supposed to be a secret duty. There is an element of accountability, public accountability, to being a juror. And just to put it in practical terms, it sometimes happens that there are jurors who fall asleep in court. I can relate. I've fallen asleep in court. But if it happens a lot, people get thrown off juries. We're not going to know, and the victims' families aren't going to know if there are jurors sleeping in this courtroom. And I think that's the kind of thing that you know, the public needs to know in a trial of this importance. And, you know, it is not a it's not solely the function of the judge to protect the anonymity of jurors. I mean, I think one of the things that people don't focus on enough is that most of the jurors who have become public people following their jury service sought out the attention themselves. They held press conferences. They wrote books. There are jurors in both O.J. Simpson trials, civil and criminal, who are still anonymous and have never said a word in public. And that's fine, and that's their right. But I don't think these extreme steps that the judge has taken are necessary at all.
You've been quoted as saying, actually, I think it was a piece you had in The New Yorker about this judge, Judge Mache, and you say, he's about as good a judge as the legal system has to offer. And that's a quite nice praise coming from you. What do you see as his qualities and qualifications?
Well, I think he is, above all, a straight shooter. He has a he sort of looks like what you imagine a wiry old Coloradan would look like.
Wears cowboy boots to court,
right? He wears
right?
cowboy boots in court, and he's kind of thin and wiry and a little bit gruff. And I think he's shown a great deal of courage already in making some very hard and unpopular decisions. The most important of which is granting a severance to Nichols and McVeigh, meaning there will be separate trials. Right. That was a very unpopular decision with the prosecutors, with the victims. It's going to be very expensive to have a second trial. But, you know, he's a straight shooter and I think made the right decision there. He's also, you know, ruled for the prosecution many, many times in the pretrial proceedings. But I think this is a guy who's been on the bench a long time. He's been a judge for almost 30 years, if you count his time as a bankruptcy judge. He's has no real political affiliations, even though he was appointed, you know, long ago by Richard Nixon. He has no grand ambitions. He's not going to looking for a promotion. I think he's just trying to do a good job here, and you know, that's to be admired.
What's his demeanor? Because some reports I was reading about him, people described him as gruff and even scary at times.
You know, as someone who used to try cases for a living, I'm all for gruff and a little scary. I mean, anyone who has any experience with lawyers knows that they have a tendency to drone on and on merely to hear the music of their own voices. Mm. And good judges know when to tell people to shut up. And Judge Mache is such a judge. I just he is a little ornery, and you know, these are big boys and girls trying this case, so I don't think that, you know, a little orneriness is going to hurt them.
You said in preparation for this trial, you've talked to a number of different people, and I'm wondering whether you've talked with families from Oklahoma City who lost loved ones in the explosions. If you've had a chance to talk to some of those people,
many of them.
What do they tell you? I mean, what do they hope this trial will do for them?
Well, it's interesting. Each big trial seems to have sort of a big story that is kind of the subtext. In the way with the Simpson case, it was race. I think in this case, in the McVeigh case, it really is the victims that capture the public attention more than any of the lawyers involved. I think, you know, the magnitude of this event, the extent of the devastation, the loss of so many people, and the way the community has reacted to this gives the victims in this case a special moral authority. And I think one of the consequences of this case is a growth in the victims' rights movement. They have had an enormous success in lobbying Congress to change certain laws regarding the Oklahoma City bombing case already, while this case is pending, to get a closed-circuit broadcast back to Oklahoma City, to get the right to both view the trial and testify during the penalty phase. And I think they are, in many respects, really the big story of this case, more than the lawyers and even more than McVeigh himself.
Tell us about what McVeigh does and how he appears as you watched him in some of the preliminary phases of this case, and just how his demeanor is in the courtroom.
I think many people initially got a very wrong impression of Timothy McVeigh from the famous perp walk, that one shot of him that's been replayed endlessly on television, leaving the jail where he was first arrested. People, I think, have a sense of him as kind of an assassin figure, kind of the loner, Hinckley, Bremer, Oswald, that we have become a real sort of archetype in American life. Tim McVeigh's different. He's an outgoing person. He's very animated. He talks to his lawyers. He looks around. He greeted his parents the first day of jury selection. He's different even from his co-defendant, Terry Nichols, who is much more the loner type. And I think that's what gives him a somewhat greater fascination than he might otherwise. This is a guy who really has strong political views, to put it mildly, and he is just someone who's a very animated part of his own case.
Is the jury sequestered in this particular trial?
No, the jury's not sequestered. The jury is anonymous. No one knows their names. Mm-hmm. And they will be gathering at a central and unidentified location every day and brought to the courthouse together in a bus, so they won't have to go in and out on their own. But they are not sequestered. They'll be living in their own homes throughout the trial.
Well, Jeffrey, I want to talk some more, but we're going to take a short break first. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's also a legal analyst for ABC News. And he joins us from Denver, and he's covering the case of the trial of Timothy McVeigh, accused of the bombing in Oklahoma City just about 2 years ago. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and we're talking about the trial in Denver, which begins today, the trial of Timothy McVeigh. Let's talk about each side of this particular trial, the trial of Timothy McVeigh. What is the prosecution's case against McVeigh as it stands now?
To put it simply, there are really three areas of the prosecution's case that are important. The first is the issue of motive. And this is the idea that McVeigh is a right-wing extremist who had a tremendous grievance against the government, principally because of the storming of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, 1 year to the day, 2 years to the day before the bombing. And that is going to be a central part of the case. The second part is McVeigh's involvement in preparing the bomb, most importantly renting the Ryder truck under a pseudonym, which was the truck that exploded.
Right.
And of course his involvement in buying the ingredients, the fertilizer, the jet fuel that the government claims was used to make the bomb. And the third area is the forensic and scientific area, most dramatically what the government claims is bomb residue on McVeigh's shirt at the time he was arrested, and the entire scientific investigation of what the bomb consisted of and how McVeigh was tied to it.
The prosecution team is headed by an attorney named Joseph Hartzell. And he gets around in a motorized scooter. I understand that he has MS. Can you give us a feel for the style, the approach of this prosecution team headed up by this man?
Well, Joe Hartzler is a very interesting story. He was a successful prosecutor in Chicago throughout the 1980s and was a big athlete, a big sort of man about town, and got married and discovered he had MS and decided to sort of slow down his life a little and left the big city and moved to Springfield, Illinois, where he remained in the U.S. Attorney's Office, but in that more slower-paced environment where he gets to coach Little League and manage his health. Notwithstanding that change in life, he immediately volunteered to get involved in this case and will be the lead prosecutor in this case. One of the curious things about the way he's organized the case is that it's really a team effort with about a half dozen prosecutors. Hartzler argued almost no pretrial motions and did not participate in jury selection. Three other lawyers prosecution lawyers question the jurors. So his involvement, while central, is going to be but one of a significant team.
Now, his counterpart is Timothy McVeigh's attorney. His name is Stephen Jones, and he's from Oklahoma City himself and has kind of described himself as a country lawyer. He's someone that has a fairly fiery personality, as I understand it. Describe how he appears to be defending his client, what his approach
is. I tell you, every time these guys, there must be a school somewhere where they all get to say, you know, I'm just a country lawyer. You know, and it's like, you know, as soon as you hear that, reach for your wallet and make sure it's still there. The fact is, he is not a country lawyer. He is a Anglophile. Used to work for Richard Nixon. He's very successful lawyer. He's not a country lawyer, but you know he's got that kind of twang, and he cultivates that he cultivates that appearance. He has been a very aggressive media lawyer. He has cultivated reporters. He has been very active in the way that the prosecution has not, talking in public about the weaknesses of the case. You can be sure that the central parts of his case will be attacking the eyewitness testimony that puts McVeigh at various places at various times, and attacking the science, the much maligned FBI lab that attempts to tie McVeigh to the crime. What is questionable is, in briefs and in interviews, he's talked a lot about the possibility of foreign involvement in this bombing. Whether he can get any of that in front of the jury is much more of an open question, and I think that's going to be one of the interesting themes as this case unfolds.
Do you know why he took this case? Again, he's an attorney from Oklahoma City, the scene of this horrible crime. I know that he's had death threats because he has decided to be Timothy McVeigh's attorney. Has he spelled out his reasons why he wanted to take this case?
The one thing that is for sure is that Stephen Jones is having the time of his life. Lawyers love this. Everyone in the world knows who Stephen Jones is now. And he thinks that's great. This is an exciting case. It's a difficult case. If he wins, he'll be acclaimed as the greatest lawyer in all of the United States. If he loses, it's going to be because people see that this was an overwhelming case. He's assembled a vast team here. Of lawyers, 14 lawyers, all at taxpayer expense. I think he is in no hurry for this experience to end.
Earlier this year, Stephen Jones had a problem. A purported confession leaked out from the defense team and ended up on the pages of the Dallas Morning News, and it was questions about whether McVeigh had actually confessed to this crime or whether it was a kind of a trick, as Jones said, to get another witness to talk. How much do you think this leaked story has hurt Timothy McVeigh's case?
Well, it certainly hasn't helped, that's for sure. I mean, one of the fortunate things is when this story broke, the judge had already sent jury notices out to the pool of about 1,000 people from whom the jury was drawn. In that jury notice, they were told, try to avoid reading about or following on television any news about the case. During jury selection, one thing that struck me was that a lot of these jurors had followed those instructions pretty well, or
really?
At least seemed to. The jury selection was a great lesson in humility for me as a journalist. These people found my commentary and everyone else's commentary about this case quite missable, and they were remarkably uninformed about much about this case. So I think while certainly this story didn't do Jones and of course his client any good, I think it wasn't quite as devastating as I expected it was going to be.
I want to talk more about some of the evidence and some of the people who will be appearing at this trial. And I know that the prosecution is going to bring a friend, I guess a former friend of Timothy McVeigh's to the stand, a fellow named Michael Fortier. He was an army buddy of McVeigh. What does the prosecution hope to prove with his testimony, Michael Fortier?
Well, this witness, if he performs as advertised, is going to be pure gold for the prosecution. You know, it is one of the chilling and fascinating parts of this case that in the late 1980s, in basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, there were, in a very small class, Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier, and they became friends, and they served in the Army together, and McVeigh served in the Persian Gulf War, and they stayed in touch. And McVeigh discussed with Fortier extensively his growing alienation from the government and his anger at gun control and his anger at the crisis in Waco. And according to what appears, you know, what we've learned through various means, Fortier will testify that McVeigh said he wanted to blow up the Murrow Building as a political protest. Now, if the jury believes him, the case is more or less over.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for ABC News. He'll join us in the second half of the show as we talk more about the Oklahoma City bombing trial. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's continue our conversation with reporter Jeffrey Toobin, who's out in Denver to cover the Oklahoma City bombing trial for The New Yorker and ABC News. Timothy McVeigh is charged with blowing up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, which killed 168 people, making it the worst domestic terrorist attack in U.S. history. One of the problems facing the prosecution is the integrity of their evidence, which has been undermined by a scathing report about the FBI crime lab. Some 2 tons of material from Oklahoma City were taken to the crime lab, and this report actually singled out some of the work done on this case and questioned some of the procedures and questioned some of the conclusions. How much do you think the prosecution can rely on the FBI crime lab to help their case?
Well, it's important to remember that the prosecutors in this case have known that report was coming for months and months and have been planning on dealing with this problem. I mean, what they have decided to do, and it's actually rather striking, is almost to try this case as if the FBI lab didn't exist. By that I mean they have basically taken every piece of evidence that was removed from Oklahoma City and that they plan to introduce and given it to an expert from Scotland Yard, a unassailable, uncontroversial, widely respected analyst from Scotland Yard who reanalyzed everything. And the prosecution is not really going to call anyone from the FBI lab whose work is in question at all. So I think this problem will not really be as big as it seems when the trial plays out. But I think it is rather extraordinary and a sad commentary that here you have the premier crime lab, supposedly, I mean, certainly the most well-known crime lab in the United States, and you have the most important crime of the decade in the United States, and the government is so embarrassed by the lab that they're not even going to call a single witness from it. It's a pretty shocking commentary.
Do you think this case is going to hinge on DNA and some other sort of arcane scientific information, EDTA, which we heard about from the O.J. Simpson trial? Since most of the case against McVeigh as it stands now is circumstantial, there's no eyewitness that can put him at the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And there are just many, seems to me, holes in the case at this point, which makes me wonder about whether, again, it's going to come down to all sorts of complex scientific analysis of clothing and pieces of Ryder truck.
I don't think so. I think a great deal of it is going to be eyewitness testimony, putting McVeigh at different places, not at the crime scene, but you know the critical testimony of him renting the truck. And I think it's also important to remember there's a lot of corroboration of the eyewitness testimony here, and I don't think it's going to be extremely complicated. For example, the truck was rented under the name Robert Kling. Michael Fortier's wife will testify that she made a fake ID for Tim McVeigh under the name Robert Kling. In fact, the ID that was used to rent this truck. handwriting analysis will say that that handwriting that McVeigh's handwriting is on the rental agreement for that truck. On another subject, a receipt for purchase of an enormous amount of the kind of fertilizer that was used in this bomb. There's a fingerprint on that receipt, which is found at Terry Nichols' house, a fingerprint of Timothy McVeigh. It's these kind of things that I think the case will hinge on, and that, I don't think, is all that complicated.
One of the books that apparently is a favorite of Timothy McVeigh, and has been apparently rather influential on his thinking, is a book called The Turner Diaries. Have you read this book?
I have indeed.
And what's your take on it?
This book is the American Mein Kampf. I mean, it is an absolutely full-throated, genocidal book about how the white people will rise against a government that is crazed and taken over by left-wingers and blacks and people who want to want to restrict gun ownership, and it includes acts of tremendous violence, including the bombing of an FBI building, much like the charge in this case.
Do you think this book will play a role in this trial?
A huge role, because in McVeigh's car when he was arrested were pointed excerpts from the book, and several of McVeigh's friends and acquaintances will testify about how McVeigh was motivated by the political tenets in that book.
And Jones's job is really to just keep reminding the jury that if they come to a verdict of guilty, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. They have to be entirely certain that Timothy McVeigh committed this crime. That's his job, yes?
His job is, as defense lawyers always say, they don't have to prove anything.
Right.
They don't have to prove that someone else did it. They don't even have to prove that McVeigh didn't do it. They only need to show that the government's evidence is not sufficiently reliable. And I expect that this will be a very scattershot defense, plucking away at each individual piece of evidence in an effort to show that the entire narrative can't be pieced together. You know, it's important to remember that, you know, people get convicted of crimes every day and most of the time in criminal cases. So it's not like this burden is insurmountable. But I think especially in high-profile cases, jurors take their jobs very seriously, and they are going to be looking to make sure all the dots connect.
And is this a death penalty case, in that if McVeigh is found guilty, he could be sentenced to death?
The way this case will work is the jury will first decide guilt or not guilty. There will then be, if there's a verdict of guilty on the principal charge, a separate proceeding, new witnesses, new lawyers for the prosecution, who will argue that McVeigh should get death rather than life without parole. And that will be a very different proceeding with different rules, and it is likely to be highly, highly dramatic if and when it happens.
You're both a lawyer and a journalist, and I wonder whether when you're covering a case as a journalist, either this one or the O.J. Simpson trial or other cases that might not be quite so high profile, whether there are times you wish you were a lawyer and not a journalist, that you wish you were arguing the case.
You know, this is one of the things that surprises me. The answer to that question is an emphatic no.
Really?
I mean, I really have switched over. I mean, I'm very glad to have been a prosecutor. I love being a lawyer. I had a great time doing it. But I think the worst thing you can do in my position is to pretend you were some kind of, you know, God's gift to the lawyering profession and think that you could do everything better than the people who are up there. One thing I have is an appreciation that what all these lawyers do is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, maybe individual questions or individual witnesses, I think, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. But I really don't sit there and compare my skills to theirs. I mean, I think I have a great degree of empathy for the difficulties and pressures that they face. But I'm a retired lawyer and no plans to change that status.
Well, I know that cameras are forbidden in federal courtrooms, and you covered both O.J. Simpson trials, of course, one with cameras and one without. Do you have a position on that, whether you think it's a good thing or not a good thing to have cameras in the courtroom?
Well, it's a good thing that I'm not running for office, because I could be accused of flip-flopping on the issue of cameras in the courtroom many times. I would often change my position daily on that question, and I can't say that I have a finely tuned position. I guess at the end of the day, I think that, you know, what goes on in courtrooms is the public's business, for better or for worse. And yes, in a very small handful of the most high-profile cases, and by that I mean O.J. Simpson and perhaps a very small others, the cameras do have an impact. Mm-hmm. They do change people's opinions. I mean, change people's behavior. But I think that is a price to pay, a price worth paying for letting the public know how the legal system works. I mean, the fact is we live in a society where most people get the vast majority of their information electronically. And much as I have a reverence for the printed word, that it simply is not as good to let people know what goes on in courtrooms as showing them. And, you know, it's their courtrooms. It's not the judges and it's not the lawyers. So I think they ought to say it. They ought to be able to see it.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, we're out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure, Marty. I hope we talk again.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for ABC News. His book about another high-profile trial, The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, is out in paperback. This is Fresh Air.